This episode is brought to you by the SolarWinds APM Suite. Simplify your full-stack monitoring for hybrid, Azure, AWS, and other cloud-native IT environments, and gain valuable performance insights across user experience, applications, services, and infrastructure. Visit solarwinds.com/APM Suite.
The SolarWinds Cloud Confession 2020 survey explores how extensively technology professionals are using APM tools, whether on-premises or for SaaS-based application management, and how they monitor these environments. It also showcases areas where tech pros feel confident in their APM tools and strategies, and challenges and avenues for building confidence. This year's survey shows that most tech pros are using APM tools in a troubleshooting capacity and not as part of proactive APM strategies to achieve optimization. It's easy to say APM solutions must be more than reactive troubleshooting tools, but it's far more challenging to determine what's holding companies, teams, and individual contributors back from achieving it. I'm Leon Adato, and with me today to discuss potential solutions and explain the opportunities of fully leveraging APM across the entire application stack is Adam Bertram, known to his friends and internet groupies as Adam the Automator. Welcome to TechPod.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Adam, we like to start off TechPod with a little bit of shameless self-promotion. This is where you get to tell folks where they can find you on the interwebs or projects that you're working on or things that they can keep their eye out for. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So as you said, I'm Adam Bertram. I'm a Microsoft MVP, online business pro, I guess you could say, content writer, trainer, and I do a lot of technical writing, especially on the interwebs. You can find me mostly at adamtheautomator.com, which is my my blog, and also recently released my first ever published book, which is PowerShell for Sysadmins. You can find that out at powershellforsysadmins.com.
Nice. I'm going to have to pick that up. I know that a bunch of the members of our audience are really into PowerShell, and I think that that's going to be really interesting to them. Just to round things out, I'm Leon Adato. I'm a head geek for SolarWinds. Yes, head geek is actually my job title. You can find me on the Twitters, as the youngins like to say, at Leon Adato. You can also find me on thwack.com. That's the SolarWinds user forum. About 150,000 folks all hanging out, talking about whatever tickles their fancy. You can find me there at Adato L-E, that's my last name and first two initials. And if you're scribbling any of that down, stop it. Just sit back and relax and listen to this because we're going to have links and references on the episode page. As I mentioned in the intro, a lot of this conversation is inspired by the 2020 Cloud Confession Report. You can find that at solarwinds.com/cloudconfessions. And you might want to check that out because there's a lot of statistics and graphs and charts showing the details behind some of the talking points that we're going to have. We're going to hit a really wide range of topics that are mostly focused around APM, from cloud and DevOps to hybrid IT, into the nature of IT work that we do. So I think, Adam, what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time sort of defining our terms. I think as IT professionals, we like to define our terms before we go off and code things or build things or whatever. So I think the first thing is, you know, let's talk about cloud. You know, generally, which, and whatever the opposite is, my fellow head geek, Thomas Arock, likes to say earthed, which I think is funny, but it's hard to say clearly enough that people know what you're saying. But cloud and the other place, on-prem or whatever, it can mean a lot of things. So what are some of the common types of environments that you encounter in the workplace as it relates to cloud?
Yep. So, I mean, I think that, as you said, there is kind of, there's the cloud and then there's on-prem or on-premises. Don't ever say on-premise or you'll probably be shot online. But essentially there's, you know, I think there's like kind of three. You have the old style, kind of the monolithic approach to where, you know, everything is all kind of bundled in one executable and it's all one binary and everything is managed that way. And then you kind of have the second type, which is the SOA type or service oriented architecture, where things are sort of distributed more. They have kind of different categories and services, but some services still kind of interact with one another to some degree. And then finally, to kind of kick off that evolution, I guess, if you will, in software architecture, where you kind of have nowadays, you have lots of microservices and DevOps, to where everything is completely separated. It's all its own entity. And at that point, you have everything is its own kind of its own little monolith, I guess that you want to say, but they're really tiny monoliths and they all have to manage. We have to all manage the dependencies, how they all work together.
Right. And I think it's important for people who are saying, wait, microservice. I don't have a microservices. I don't have it. We're not talking about environments the way that traditional IT pros might think of. We're going to talk about that also. We're going to talk about hybrid IT and things like that. But we're talking about application architectures. You know, there's ways of approaching the building of an application. And it starts off sounding familiar. It sounds, you know, monolithic, traditional, on-premises, et cetera. Oh, okay, I know where I am. And suddenly you're getting into SOA and microservices. And wait a minute, how do I build that? It's slightly different. It's slightly off. So I guess on that point, you know, for people who are listening to this and maybe don't feel like they're programmers as the main part of their job, they might do some scripting or whatever. What do these distinctions mean to you as a generalist tech practitioner? Like, how do you approach them in your work and your daily, you know, job?
I definitely think that you're right. A lot of those terms are traditionally software development terms, but you know, in this day and age, I think many IT pros need to at least have a basic understanding. Sure, the software developer is going to be knowing a lot more about the ins and outs of those terms. But as an IT professional, you know, you are on the ops side of DevOps. So you need to know how to manage those services at a high level. And then from going to the point of this talk today is how to monitor those services, and just monitoring those services and just understanding at a high level to be able to, you know, if somebody calls you, if something happens in the middle of the night, one of your monitors goes off and you get paged or, you know, something like that in the middle of the night, you need to be able to understand the software at least at a high level to know, to tell the, call the developer on standby or something. Hey, this problem, this piece of the code is doing this. How do we get this resolved?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Is that even if you're not going to build these kinds of environments or even work in these kinds of environments, again, microservices being the most extreme, I think, you know, in terms of distance from traditional ops work, you still have to have an understanding of it and see how it fits into your architecture. But I do want to take a minute and talk about that. I want to talk about the hardware environments that we're discussing. Now, again, on-prem is where it starts, but what's the progression from there on up to the sky?
Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about from on-prem to cloud, traditionally companies that have maybe a monolithic structure or have some certain line of business applications, they will first do the lift and shift model. So as an IT pro, you most likely would get involved with the lift and shift. So let me take a step back. There's the lift and shift model, which is essentially taking maybe your VMs that are running in Hyper-V or VMware on-prem and essentially just taking those and throwing those into the cloud. Maybe you're going to have some reconfiguration in there, changing how the networking works and changing how the figuring out what kind of compute size that you need for the cloud VM, which essentially that's the easiest model to use. You're essentially taking that one package that you have and putting that into the cloud. And then you also have, that's the easiest way. Then you also have the model where you essentially, the software developers themselves re-architect the application to live natively in the cloud. If you wanted to get buzzwordy, you get cloud native, to where those applications are natively aware of all of the PaaS services. There's IaaS, infrastructure as a service, or the VMs don't even really come into the mix when you talk about cloud native, because everything has an API. Everything uses the platform as a service options here and there. Then that's when we go into, you know, buzzwords like serverless and things like that. So essentially there's two ways to get into the cloud. But what I found is what traditionally companies that really don't have a lot of cloud experience, or they have very, very complicated applications, whether they're monolithic or SOA applications, they tend to say, well, we want to go to the cloud, get the advantages, all the cost savings and the scalability of the cloud, but we don't really want to go to the re-architecturing of the entire application, which that may come in down the line.
Got it. Okay, this is a really good mapping. Thank you. So I guess the next question, now that we've defined what the environments are and how they sort of map together, is, you know, why has the industry moved from this centralized model to where we are today? You know, it's worth taking a minute and looking at the history and saying, well, why are we here? Because there are people who would say that lift and shift is also known as the, you know, bring a wheelbarrow full of cash model, because you're going to, you know, take your existing environment and move it straight up. But it's not optimized for that. So it's just going to start chewing through workloads and resources. And some applications are more successful than others that way. But why are we going this way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that you kind of have two camps there. You have the companies that maybe don't have the necessary talent or the skill to really understand. You don't have cloud engineers. You have system administrators that are just have only been focused on-prem their entire lives, and cloud is kind of the new thing. And so, but the CIO or has been hearing all about cloud computing. Everything has to go to the cloud. And that's the point to where, you know, it just that they tend to use the lift and shift model rather than actually re-architecting the application, because being in the cloud and being on-prem is significantly different. Some people may disagree. We say, well, it's just a VM is a VM. Well, not technically, but I think for the most part that the way reason people are going to the cloud is the CIO sees scalability. The CFO sees cost savings, because we only pay for what we use. But like you said, if it's a lift and shift model, if they're actually just taking the VMs that they're using that are running 24/7 and throw them up in the cloud, a lot of people, if they don't manage and plan for those costs, they don't monitor those costs, then it can leave definitely a black eye for a lot of organizations.
Right. Okay. So when we talk about defining our terms, one topic jumped out at me from the survey itself. There's a lot of confusion around what APM was, when and how it should be used, which kind. There were quotes, everything from, you know, quote, there's the confusion around which tools are ideal for specific IT environments is consistent. Another quote, lack of awareness of what APM solutions are currently offered and confusion over which currently offered APM solution are best for their needs. And finally, another quote that jumped out at me was, knowing which combination of APM elements are right for your environment. These all were direct comments about the data from the survey. And it takes me to one of the main points of the report, which is APM tools and uses. So there's nuances that we're going to gloss over here. I mean, we only have a limited amount of daylight to do this. There's outside in versus inside out type monitoring. There's server side technologies like logging and metrics and stuff like that. I want to spend a moment on the basic explanations and use cases for synthetic transactions versus real time user monitoring. So I'll take your side of this, Adam. Which one do you want to explain? And then I'll explain the other one.
I can take the synthetic user transactions.
Great. Go for it.
Well, truth be told, not a complete expert. Whatever I go back to user transaction monitoring, I go back to the days when I was a System Center Operations Manager admin. So going to kind of relating this term to SCOM, which I'm sure a lot of IT professionals will be familiar with, there was always in SCOM, you have the management packs. And then inside of the management packs, there is various ways to monitor. You know, there's your typical up down, your ping monitoring, your port monitoring, that sort of thing. And then there was always that synthetic user monitoring piece inside of SCOM. And I got to looking at it, and at first I was like, wow, this is really cool, because at the time I was used to more of the up down. Does it ping? Is a port open, or is a specific user? There's some kind of configuration. But whenever I dug into the synthetic user monitoring, what I found was we had to set up the actual kind of agents on each of the machines. So I'm not for sure if this is different in any other environment, but when you talk about a System Center Operations Manager, we have to set up agents. So it actually mimicked real behavior. So if you're familiar with maybe Selenium, it was a web app where it mimicked real user behavior, clicking on a menu, going to this item. And I mean, that's where the synthetic user part comes. It's a synthetic, yeah, kind of made up user that goes through and interacts with the application and then monitors things like return response time for the website. How long did this element take to bring up in a page? Oh, did this element come up right? So that is my that's my experience with synthetic user monitoring, which it came into be. It was great at the time because it really got really granular in what the various metrics that we should monitor.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. And for those people who are looking for the SolarWinds Rosetta Stone here, we're talking about either Web Performance Monitor or Pingdom. Those are two tools that do synthetic user. We have other tools that will also do it. And my best use case for that, just in case people are still having trouble wrapping their head around it, is one of our former head geeks, who's now the product manager for one of our other products, Destiny Bertucci, got front row tickets to Aerosmith using synthetic transactions. What she did was she set up a synthetic transaction that checked the ticket sales system, and it said not on sale yet, and she wanted an alert as soon as it did not say not on sales yet. So she would go to the ticket system, that web page, click over to the Aerosmith page, and look for the absence of the sentence not on sale yet. And as soon as it said that, her phone went off, she jumped on the site, bought tickets, got them right away. So you can look for, you're mimicking a user, but you know, think about the most annoying, obnoxious hit F5 refresh kind of experience you're thinking of. That's the thing, that's what synthetic user transactions can do for you. Now, on the other side, real user monitoring, or RUM, is looking at actual users. What there are, again, agents that are injecting code into the stream, into the either the user's browser or from different points within the transaction flow. And they're, from time to time, reporting back on how long it's taken for them to get to the next step, or where they're, what they're doing, or what have you. And that tells you, user by user, now sometimes it's sampled, and sometimes you're getting every single user's experience, but you're seeing the real experience of users as they're moving their way through the system. You're seeing that that database query, while it is running quickly on the database, is still not returning data fast enough to not slow down a particular experience. And that's a big deal. It's not the same as synthetic. We're not saying good, you know, better or worse, because at 2 o'clock in the morning, if nobody's on the system, you won't know. And so you're going to have to wait for users to jump on the system to find out. Meanwhile, synthetic user transaction only happens from a specific set of locations. You may not know that the users in Tupelo, Mississippi, or San Francisco, or Cleveland, Ohio, are having an experience because you're only monitoring it from Paris and New York and Los Angeles, for example. So there are pros and cons to each one of them. The reason why I wanted to go through that is because I want to talk about your feelings on which tool is best, you know, which use case fits the tool best. You know, when, if somebody came to you and said, well, I'm just not sure what to apply, you know, how would you guide them?
Well, I think it depends on how granular you need to get. So coming back to your example, what I was thinking of, another good term to define synthetic user transaction is web scraping. So, you know, you take a website, you can, you know, scrape all the stuff off the website. So maybe I've done this in the past where maybe a program, a service that you love, you need to automate, doesn't have an API. So you go down to the bowels of web scraping and create Selenium scripts, or create some PowerShell scripts, or some Python modules and things, where it's a pain to figure out all the elements on the page and everything like that. So that's one thing. If you're not really looking for very granular information, so for example, like you said, that's a good example. You can set up a monitor to monitor for a specific string in a web page, or you can monitor when a new element, a new image comes on. Maybe it's an application that has, you know, whenever a new entry is, you want to be pinged whenever a new entry is made, and that entry is defined by an image on the web page. You can monitor on that. If you wanted to get more more granular, I guess, more quote unquote devy, where you can inject and have the application, have this, the monitoring service really understand what's going on under the hood, understand the HTML and the whole, and that even back to the storage and the database to map out, you know, when this button, when this user clicks on this button, okay, how long is the time to, how long does it take the web page to paint a picture? How long does it take for the user to get a response? But how long does it take to go to the database? How long does the database read take? So if you think about an application, you know, from a really granular perspective, you know, like there's that website that had, I can't remember what it was, like, this is what it takes to actually bring up google.com. And it was, you know, the DNS query, all the web elements, the database, all of the network, all of that stuff has to come into play. And I think with real user monitoring, especially where it gets more granular and allows you to understand each hop along there and to understand their performance and where those bottlenecks are.
Yes. And that's the aspect of tracing. Right. Yes. Where you're actually tracing the entire transaction from cradle to grave and you're watching every step along the way. And I think, you know, something that you had said as we were talking through this topic before we started up was that the buzzwords a lot of times are what gets in the way, that, you know, an engineer just wants to know. They don't know synthetic transaction. They just want to know the tool that acts like a user even when they're not there or what have you, that the buzzwords get in the way. So you had gone through some of the APM, you know, tools that monitor architecture. You talked about the different kinds or states. And I wondered if you could do that for the folks who are listening.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, if you're talking about how to monitor the three different, you know, environments, the monolith, SOA, and microservices, what you typically talk about, just removing a lot of the software development-esque terms from the fact, essentially what you're doing is going from, you know, old school, we used to just set up a ping monitor. Well, if an ICMP packet got from point A to point B and I got it back, oh, everything is great.
Those days were so simple. I missed them so much.
Yeah, you just set up your ping monitor. If the server pings, then everything is great. Well, nowadays, you know, you have to get more granular. You know, just because a server pings and returns a decent response time doesn't necessarily mean the
squat. It doesn't necessarily mean squat.
Exactly. Even if the port is listening, okay, well, I'm going to go a little bit, make sure port 80 is listening. Okay, well, that's great. Well, does the actual, you know, is the user actually, is the web page coming up? Okay, well, if you go a little bit farther, everything, the whole monitoring, the ecosystem has led to more of a granular, I guess, evolution of monitoring, to where it's not just up, down. Nothing is up, down. You know, at my previous position, I was always, I was one of those guys always asking, well, what does it mean to be up and what does it mean to be down? And some of the guys were looking at me like, you know, I had a third eyeball or something, because they kept, because they didn't, you know, if you're not kind of in that frame of mind to where you don't see a green or a red, now it's not a green or red, it's a green and an orange, you know, you have the tools.
And a blue
red.
And a purple and a light shade of mauve.
Completely down. Or you have yellow or orange, which is maybe degraded service. And then you have red, which is completely down. Oh, my God, we have to fix this thing. No user's going to get in there. It's a gradual scale now. And I think that's what we need as IT professionals. We need to really understand that nothing is really up down anymore. And that's where we go back into the real-time user monitoring and synthetic user transaction monitoring, because that mimics what we truly, truly care about is how the users using the services, what their experience is like. So we're trying to measure what the user experience is like rather than what we see in the back end. We say, oh, it's responded on TCP port 80. Well, the user doesn't care at all about that. User just cares if the web page comes up, it's responsive, and it does what it was supposed to do.
Right. At SolarWinds, we like to remind people that slow is the new down. And it, you know, it doesn't matter if all the servers are up. What was it? Charity Majors was pretty famous for saying five nines doesn't matter if your user's not happy.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, because they're not really mad. We need to measure user experience. Now that's really hard. It's kind of a cushy kind of pie in the sky, you know, thing. But I think that's what we're really trying to get at nowadays.
Well, and I'm going to say, putting on my grizzled old ops veteran hat, that it's both and. It's not either or. You do need to know that, you know, the bandwidth, the WAN connection is in. To your point, it's not just red and green. It's, you know, what's the status? It's Paisley. Okay, fine, whatever that means. But you need to know how your components are doing. But the component status doesn't necessarily relate directly back to the user experience. That is another thing. And as I said before, the components could all be perfectly happy and the user experience is still bad. And you know what? You're still on the hook for it. Mm-hmm. You as the IT person still have to deal with that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I really think the everything goes back to really the end goal of the user experience. I think that more of the traditional ops is the WAN looking good, is the do we have enough storage. I think those are more should be more kind of labeled as proactive things, because if you see, you know, at the users clicking along on the web page, everything is looking great, but you don't see the storm coming to where you're going to run out of, you know, disk space. You definitely need that. Those are more, to me, it seems like those are more proactive monitors versus the user experience. That's more real time right now monitoring.
I will remind listeners that FCAPS is still a perfectly good framework to look at and use, that fault is just one of the letters, that, you know, FCAPS, fault, capacity, access, performance, and security. That capacity, what you're talking about, do I have enough space, and performance, how is it working, are both wonderful reasons to also monitor. I'll also remind everyone that baselining, meaning I'm watching it all the time so that I know what normal looks like, so that I can tell you when it's not normal. You know, does it 80% may be so abnormal that you need to look at it. In other cases, 80% is a big yawn, but you won't know until you know what the normal average run state is for a particular system, device, you know, number of customer connections, sales per hour, whatever that number is that you're monitoring. It's, we're not just talking about CPU, but if you don't have the normal, if you don't baseline it, you'll never know what the variance away from that baseline is.
Yeah. Nowadays, that used to be really, really hard to establish the baseline. Nowadays, with AI and machine learning, that we can use those tools and technologies to really help us define, okay, what is normal and what's not.
So something I want to take a look at that jumped out at me is that the top three commonly deployed tools to support APM, this is straight off of the survey, was database monitoring, application monitoring, and infrastructure monitoring. And those three things do not scream APM to me. So what that says to me is that there are tools that you use to help monitor the stuff that APM is monitoring, or that there's things that fill in the gaps or something like that. And I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think at some point you have to think about, you know, all these different layers of monitoring. And at some point you have to realize, well, who is watching the watcher? You know, you could have instances to where you have I kind of think I take this back to testing, to unit testing and integration testing and all those software development testing terms, to where this is a common thing that goes into here. Well, if you have tests to test, if you're in a DevOps environment, if you have tests to verify that your virtual machine was deployed successfully, does it ping? Is it on? Is it responding on the port? Is it you know, providing the right web page? You can monitor and write tests for all those as soon as a new piece of infrastructure is deployed. But at some point, I've gotten a lot of questions about this, because I've actually wrote a book that's called The Pester Book. It's a PowerShell testing framework. And one of those big questions was...
Wait, do you say pester as in bother me?
Pester, yeah. Pester is the PowerShell testing framework.
Okay.
It's built in PowerShell and allows you to do unit testing with PowerShell code or PowerShell modules and script, just like you would C Sharp or, you know, Java or anything like that. But yeah, because I wrote that book, I get a lot of questions about testing. Well, why do I need testing? Same way with, I can even go back to configuration management. If we go into something like Puppet or Chef or desired state configuration, DSC, you know, you have tools that are supposed to provide you a platform to say, I want this server to look like this. Changes some registry keys, install some software, put some files wherever it needs to. And then I commonly get the question, well, what are we, that's one layer. And then I get the question, well, why do we need to test that if your configuration management tool is already doing it? And it does raise a good point to where then if you ask, well, why is this going to be, why do we need to test this? Where do I trust? It all comes down to trust. So, you know, are you going to trust that your configuration management tool is doing it? Are you okay? If you're not, I'm going to write tests for that. I'm going to monitor this, whether it's you're going to talk about configuration drift or anything like that. I'm going to write tests to make sure I'm going to create a monitor to monitor this. Well, at some point, you know, okay, then you say, well, I'm going to monitor the monitor. At some point, you have to realize, well, I have to eventually end up in something. I have to trust this is the golden parent tool of all of my monitoring. And if this tool says that my users are experiencing a hard time or my WAN link is down or something like that, you just have to kind of trust it. I mean, you can get, you know, a lot of us IT people, we can kind of be OCD sometimes. Well, not quite for sure. I don't really trust it. But at some point, I think it all comes down to trust, and you just have to trust kind of that monitoring or testing tool.
So as IT professionals, we do live in a heterogeneous reality, which is, there isn't a single tool that we use monolithically across things, that we use a variety of tools and a variety of solutions. And so, yes, I have to trust that the data I'm getting back from this test or this system is true. I also have my sanity check, that backup system that will verify for me that the things I'm seeing from the first one are also true, whether that's a technique or a tool. It depends on the context. But at the end of the day, you do have to believe the information that you're getting. Otherwise, you're going to be chasing shadows your entire time. And we've seen that, right? We've seen where somebody comes in and says, this code is actually incredibly inefficient. It's like, what are you talking about? I wrote my heart out. This is the best code I've ever written. And then they put into a tool and they show that it's taking, you know, minutes to execute. And on top of that, it's not just it's not running well, but where is it falling down? What isn't working on it? And again, that takes us back to whether it's synthetic transaction, real user monitoring, tracing, et cetera, that tells us that. I think by this point, folks listening may think, all right, I get it. APM is good. I need some of this stuff in my life. But there is a gotcha, and I'm just going to read from the report. In terms of code analysis, APM solutions provide great value in identifying problems in code that report when a transaction or application is slow or failing. However, these applications are not always built by your company, but are instead purchased, which is an important differentiation or delineation. Knowing where the problem is in the code is only valuable if it's your code. So, Adam, you've seen things. You've lived a life, as I understand it.
I have. I have barely enough hair to show for it, too.
Exactly. So I was wondering how this resonated with you.
Yeah, so I can go back to many, many stories, but the one that is top of mind, it was from a previous position that I was in, where I was brought in as a DevOps or an automation engineer. And, you know, me being the PowerShell guy, I tend to do everything in PowerShell, and unfortunately, so did this company. Any listeners out there realize that, well, PowerShell isn't necessarily a quote-unquote development language, but, you know, there's lots of tools that kind of coincide or work well with PowerShell. PowerShell is kind of known to be the glue that fits everything together, kind of fills in the gaps of the functionality gaps of lots of different services and software. Well, the company that I was brought in to decided, well, I'm going to build a complete automation orchestration engine with PowerShell from the ground up. So,
like you do.
Yeah, exactly. Think about, at the time I was like, this is awesome because I love writing PowerShell. I mean, because now I'm essentially a PowerShell developer. I get to do it all the time. But just give you a sense of what this tool did. It was essentially an environment orchestration engine. So we were kind of brought in to automate the provisioning of test environments, whether that be on-prem, in the cloud. So for example, take a developer puts in a request, say, I need a test environment for XYZ application. Well, it was our job to automate the provisioning of that. So that may consist of two or three VMs all clustered together with the database, all the web app, the web front end, all the networking, everything to where essentially a one click, here I want this application, click, and you have everything brought up. And we wrote all of that orchestration, all of the code that it took to do that in PowerShell, because well, you can do pretty much anything with PowerShell. But what we got to seeing was we were facing challenges that that were taking so much longer to do because there was other configuration and management tools out there. So for example, whenever we would want to create a new virtual machine, for example, we could create it once, but then the developer would say, okay, well, I want it again. I'm just going to run this again. And then it would error out. Well, because it wasn't idempotent. It didn't, the PowerShell scripts that we wrote didn't natively understand if there's a VM out there, then don't try to create it again. But fortunately, we had to write a bunch of if the VM exists, then do not do it. Provide. We have to write all this stuff. And it took months and months and months to do this. And what we found was that configuration management tools did a much better job at that, because then we wouldn't have to write all that functionality in. Essentially, we could use the existing modules and packages that were in those tools, and then add in our PowerShell scripts that we need and leverage all that ahead of time. And it became a nightmare managing all that and trying to reinvent the wheel. One thing that we did a few months before I was getting ready to leave that position was finally we started looking into configuration management tools, and it solved so many problems, because we were able to stand on the shoulders of giants and realize that, wow, they've already solved this problem. I don't need to do that. But on the other side of the coin is where, you know, we kind of get in that not created here syndrome, to where, oh, I don't trust this software because I didn't write it myself. But what we found out was that, you know, there's a lot of smart people on the other end developing these tools. They've already done all these things, and we just needed to realize, you know, we need to trust that they've done their, you know, due diligence. And 99.9% of the time, we had a much better time to do that.
Yeah, I think that NIH, not invented here, is only superseded by the much worse impulse, NIHBM, not invented here by me. And both, like you said, speak to a lack of trust and also just an unwillingness to recognize that even if you acquire a tool that is 80% functional, let's just go with regular Occam's Razor 80-20, you know, 80% of the way to what you need is a significant amount of time that you don't have to spend building it. And I know that at some point in that experience you just told about where you're building it yourself, somebody said, yeah, but we don't have to pay a thing for it. It's free. I mean, we're building it ourselves. We're blazing our own trail. It's only free if your time is worthless. Mm-hmm. And in any organization, I'm willing to bet there's something else that has a higher value to the business than building a tool that already exists. Yeah. In large part.
Don't get me started on those meetings where there's 20 people in there and it only needs to be one or two. And
oh, yeah, there's all that.
You know, they just don't realize, you know, people, that's a common thing to do. You don't put a value on time because, well, I'm not specifically paying for anything. But, yeah, I agree with you completely.
Yeah, so in that vein of don't get you started, I do want to pivot over to avoid the problem both of NIH and also of, you know, dealing with these code bases and things like that. The survey says one of the ways you can get around it is to develop an APM plan. And so it lists out a few bullet points, you know, inventory, assess, evaluate. And I wanted to talk through those with you just to get your take on them. Starting off with inventory. Or discovery, some people call it discovery. You know, anything that we should be thinking about there as we are working our way toward a comprehensive APM strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, you have to go into it to a mode, a discovery mode. You have to first know what's out there. You have to know, you know, what servers are that you have. You have to know what, you know, what applications are installed in those servers. Discovery and inventory is by far and away, to me, which is essentially the most important, because if you don't know what you have, that's your core foundation. You have to have a tool that will allow you to figure out what exactly you have. Once you have that, the inventory in place, then comes, you know, the assessment phase where, you know, at that point, okay, you know what I have. So taking this down to a real example, all right, my discovery tool recognized that I have a server that's in a closet somewhere or maybe under somebody's desk that nobody knew about. Great, I've discovered it. I've done my inventory. Assess. Well, oh no, that server is running a critical line of business HR application. Not that I'm talking from experience in any way. No, I would never do that. But that server is running a line of business and a critical line of business production HR application. That's your assessment phase. I think at that point, you really need to evaluate the severity of it. You know, if it's a production application that HR is using, well, whether it's under somebody's desk or not, you need to evaluate, is that going to be a good option to take that out from under the desk and put it in the data center, maybe take it to the cloud? You know, at that point, you go into testing and trial phase. Well, okay, I've inventory. I know that there's a server, a computer, a desktop computer under somebody's desk in HR. Assess, is this important or not? Yes, it's running production application. Evaluate, well, does it make sense to take this application and move it somewhere else? Well, of course it does if it's under somebody's desk. Then do you kind of take that and worry about test and trialing it, where that when you bring in maybe parts of the other team, bring in the software developers that may have built the application, maybe get the vendor involved. And at that point, you bring all that, kind of re-architect that way, maybe bring it to the cloud, for example. And once it's in the cloud, you come into more of a measuring, monitoring phase to where, okay, I've got this, built this up exactly how I want it to be. And at this point, I need to maintain the state. I need to make sure it's there. You know, configuration management tools can maintain that state, keep it in the exact state that you want. And then monitoring tools can then make sure that the performance is not only the state and the configuration, but the performance maintains at that expected level.
Nice. That was a great rundown. Thank you so much. There is a whole lot more for us to talk about. This is really just scratching the surface of the survey, but I think we've given everyone who's listening enough to think about for one sitting. So before we wrap up, I just want to give you a chance to tell everyone again, where can people find out more about you?
Sure. AdamTheAutomator.com, or you can also get me on Twitter. I'm there, probably there way too much, at A.D. Bertram.
As we all are. And if you want to read this survey and dig into the details and the data, you can find that at SolarWinds.com/cloudconfessions. Adam, thank you so much for taking time today.
Yep. Thanks for having me.